Oscar Wilde, wasn't it, who said, most people are other people. You didn't hear it?
No, I didn't hear what you said.
Oscar Wilde
yeah.
once remarked, most people are other people. So one of the ways of understanding what we're trying to do is we're trying to just become ourselves, yeah? And in a way, this is an alchemical idea. According to alchemy, everything has a sort of teleological cause, yeah?
What's that mean?
Teleological. It means it moves. I will explain what it means. This is not.
Did you make it up?
Okay, enough. Calm down, all of you. This is not a question and answer thing. Teleological means it's moving towards an end, yeah? Or something like that, anyway. It's got a telos to it, yeah? It's moving. So, for instance, I was going to give you an example, if you just hold on a minute. They will say all metal tends towards its purest state, which is gold, yeah? And this happens naturally, but takes age, you know, takes many, many millennia or ages, tens of thousands of years. And the alchemical process is trying to speed it up. So it's trying to aid something that happens naturally, if you see what I mean. And this isn't, obviously we know that that isn't literally true now, that metal isn't tending towards gold. But it is quite interesting because, of course, things like diamonds, it is sort of true for, isn't it? You know, they end up as diamonds after being, you know, they start off as some form of carbon, you know, trees or whatever, some form of carbon, and under immense heat and pressure, they end up as diamonds. You know? That's a very alchemical process, you know. So it's kind of, you know, you can see why one might think like that. And of course, gold wasn't necessarily meant to be literal gold anyway. It was gold represented purity and light, you know, the sun it represented. So it's debatable whether, certainly not all, some alchemists might have really believed that it was possible to produce gold from base metal, but others, we're working with it as a metaphor, yeah? Yeah. And this isn't so dissimilar from Buddhism, is it? Because Buddhism has this idea that we can move towards this golden state, if you like, this enlightened state, yeah? Which to some extent is inherent in the consciousness itself. So I want to say a little bit about that this morning, not too much, just a couple of sort of pick out a couple of things. One of the things that I've noticed with me over the last 30 odd years, I've kept coming back to the story of the Buddha, the historical Buddha, and I think it's very important actually that we come back to the story of the historical Buddha. Because it's partly a historical story, but actually it's mostly a mythological story or an archetypal story. So archetypal stories lay down a basic pattern. So it's laying down the basic pattern of the path for us. Yeah? And so we can keep coming back to it and we can keep finding new things in this story and see how it relates to us. So there's a couple of, we'll see how long it takes, maybe we'll just have one instance. But if we start with the Buddha's birth, let's start with the Buddha's birth. So the Buddha's, first of all, we're told that his mother knows his pr- pregnant because she has a dream of a white elephant entering her womb. This is, I mean, I'm not going to interpret that, but it's a very interesting image, isn't it? That very interesting dream. So she has this dream of a white elephant entering her womb. And we've already remarked, I've already remarked, that the white elephant is subsequently associated with the throat centre, which might be completely coincidental, I've got no idea. But anyway, she has this there. And when she does give birth, she gives birth standing up, holding onto a tree, holding onto the branches. I think it's another sow tree. I'm not sure about that. I think it's the same tree that he dies between 80 odd years later. Anyway, she gives birth, and of course he's supposed to be able to walk when he's born, and lotuses appear where his footsteps go. Anyway, but when they get him back to the palace, the mother dies of bliss a few days later. Counts vary slightly, but she dies of the bliss of giving birth to the Buddha. I find that interesting. I mean, I find that interesting. You know, it's a mythical story, but it's kind of heavy, isn't it? If your mother dies giving birth to you, and the consequence of giving birth to you, it's kind of a heavy thing to come into the world with. Her sister takes charge, doesn't he? The king is already, I think, already married to both sisters, or then marries the other sister, which isn't so. So he's brought up by his maternal aunt. Yeah. He's dead by this time, the king's wife. I guess we have more than one wife. We don't really know. And the legend, different versions are slightly different. But anyway, she dies. And of course, later on in his career, he goes up into the heavens and visits the mother. But that's another story. But the bit I wanted to pull out this morning was when he's born, they get the astrologers in, yeah? They get the astrologers in to predict his future. Now, this is very interesting because it testifies to a hermeneutic way of understanding the world. Yeah? So what's above, so below. So this idea that where the planets are situated at your birth, it's a bit arbitrary, isn't it? It could be your conception or whatever, but it doesn't really matter because the link they're making is that whatever happens down here on Earth, down here in the world, has a cosmological significance. So this is a particular way of understanding life. And it's a particular way of understanding our own life, rather than the modern condition of ennui or alienation, or feeling that we don't belong. This is the opposite. We feel that we're cosmically significant. Doesn't mean we're more significant than anybody else. It just means we're all cosmically significant. Yeah, there's some relationship between the whole, the cosmic whole, the way the cosmos is actually, the word cosmos is related to cosmetic, and we get the word cosmetic from cosmos, and actually what it used to mean in the Greek, it means the sort of actual display of the world, the beauty of the way the world, or the way the cosmos shows its face, if that makes sense, yeah? How it shows itself to itself, I suppose, or to awareness, if you like. And we talk about awareness as another kind of cosmic force. So it's a bit like you are there, you come into the world to beautify the world, or to show a particular face of the cosmos to itself. Maybe we could say that, I don't know, that just means quite interesting. But anyway, this idea that the way the planets align is related to what's going to happen to you is saying there's a connection between the macrocosm and the microcosm. So this is a particular way of understanding things, and I think quite a useful way of understanding things, as long as we don't take it too rigidly. Yeah. Anyway, another interesting thing, so I get this bloke in, I can't remember his name, but anyway, I get him in, and he says, okay, two things are going to happen. There are two alternatives. This baby is either going to grow up to be a Dharma Raja, or he's going to grow up to be a Buddha. These are the two alternatives. And again, this is interesting. So he comes into the world with some kind of destiny or fate, but it's not completely rigid, because it might go one way. He might become this righteous king. And of course, in Indian mythology and in Indian history, we get the Dharma Raja a couple of hundred years after the Buddha, don't we? Who does much without him. What was his name?
Ashoka.
Ashoka, thank you. Without him, Buddhism probably would have just died out. After conquering a huge part of India, he converts to Buddhism and then starts to be a righteous king. So we do get the Dharma Raja, but he's later on. Anyway, so he can either be a Dharma Raja or he can be a Buddha. And then we get this sort of bit like Greek tragedy, although it's not a tragedy, but the father, of course, being a dad, thinks would much rather have his son as some mighty king and as some kind of ascetic beggar guy out in the woods, which is what they were, you know. Yes, he was glorious, but actually these guys were like what we would... They looked like tramps, you know what I mean? They were revered in a way, but probably also despised in another way. This is quite often the case with these mystic, shamanic sort of people, you know. Some ways they're revered, in another way they're sort of, anyway, very low status in a certain sort of way. Anyway, the father wants him to be a king, like he's a king. He wants his son to be a king. It's a typical dad, isn't it? And of course, he does everything he can to try and manipulate. And as I say, so it's got an element of kind of tragedy to it, although it's not tragic. In tragedy, of course, the more we try and avoid the tragedy, the more it's brought on. It's brought on by us trying to avoid it. This is the sort of essence of Greek tragedy, isn't it? The more we try and avoid our fate. It's because we try and avoid our fate that we get our fate, isn't it? Anyway, but it's interesting that there are, although he comes into the world with a sort of destiny, it isn't completely fixed. It could go one way, it could go another way. And I think this is the same for all of us. We come into the world with some sort of calling or destiny, but it's not necessarily going to happen. Or it might happen in one way or it might happen in another way. Yeah. It's not necessarily going to happen in a way. What's interesting as well, for us, I think, is that in the Buddha's story, if you read his account of him as a baby and as a young boy and as a young man, he already displays all the signs of, he's very loving, he's very forgiving, he's very compassionate, and he's inclined towards asceticism in a way, right from the get-go, in a sense, you know. And I find this interesting because I think sometimes we individually, we get caught up in life and we kind of forget what our calling is. We no longer hear our calling. We no longer know why we're here. We're just getting through life. It's more or less like, okay, I'll just get through. And I know at the end I'm going to die. Oh, I just got to get through it, haven't I? And then I pop my clogs and that'd be like, none of you think like that, okay, good. And yeah, we get a bit lost, we're a bit kind of lost, we're not quite, we're just doing what we're doing because it's what we're doing, you know, it's how life has come out for us. But maybe still somewhere there's a little inkling that actually something else was possible, something else. And sometimes we can reconnect with this destiny or this calling, whatever you want to call it, by just allowing the childhood to come back. It's there, the seed. Hillman calls this the acorn theory, doesn't he? That, you know, that the mighty oak is contained in the acorn in a certain sort of way. And we can reconnect with this seed, this potentiality, like this, where possibly, just as with this transmuting of base lead to gold, the possibility is there. It doesn't have to happen, but the possibility is there. And sometimes we lose that thread, and we can reconnect with it, perhaps, by remembering our childhood, perhaps. And it's not going to necessarily be literally illustrated in the childhood, but a certain tendencies. I mean, when you talk to a lot of people, it's amazing how many people I've talked to who go on about how when they were kids they just loved nature. You know, they loved being in the woods, they loved blah blah blah. And this seems to be a very natural thing, and it's very interesting, isn't it? How far our culture and our society has gone away from that. And yet so many of us have that as such a deep longing and love. Yeah, to be in a natural world, and yet we've moved so far away from it. So you wonder how these, what seems to me to be, I wonder if it's not actually in everybody, this longing to be in this beautiful world. Anyway, that's another issue, isn't it? But it's interesting how culturally and as society we're moving further and further away from this. And actually, the whole, it's not going to be long, is it, sadly, that nature's just going to be in parks, is it, you know, reserves, and, you know, it's just going to be little parcels of the world, like museums, you know. Like old Joni Mitchell said years ago, in yellow taxi, you know, get all the trees and they put them in a tree museum, you know. Is that how it's going to be, I'm afraid, you know. If you want nature, you're going to have to go to a nature reserve. But anyway, that might or might not be, or a lot of kids, when they're kids, they might be obsessed with whatever, you know. Anyway, so maybe your longing and your calling was present, would have been present when you were very young, and to reconnect to it, maybe you have to kind of remember, do a bit of remembering. I like this idea of remembering. I'm very keen on this idea of remembering. From Plato and in the Neo-Platonist tradition, and to some extent, I think arguably in the Buddhist tradition, knowledge is not gained, it's remembered. This is the idea. We actually know everything. I suppose because in some ways we're connected with the now, you know, we're connected with the universal mind, you know, we'll talk about that, and we actually know everything, and knowledge is remembering, it's understood as a remembering. I like this idea a lot because I think it's quite different to have this idea that what we're trying to do as Buddhists, or what we're trying to do as people, is to remember something. Look, so we don't have to get more, we've already got everything. We've already got everything we're ever going to need. We don't have to get more, we don't have to accumulate. All we have to do is remember. And of course, this remembering is a very strong, I'll just mention it today, maybe we'll come back to it in the future, in another day, I don't know. One of the main, one of the most significant images, let's call it an image, an occurrence in the Buddha's life, the Buddha to be, is when the Buddha remembers himself as a child under this rose apple tree, and he remembers entering spontaneously into a state of dhyana, bliss, an insight. It's got an insight element, that incident. Very strong insight element, actually. It just happens spontaneously. And he remembers doing that, but you could also argue that the actual incident is a remembering in and of itself. That we've already got this knowledge. We already know what reality is because we participate in reality. We are reality. I think it's very important to remember that reality. We sometimes, these words are very difficult, aren't they? They're difficult words because they're conceptual words. They only ever approximate to something. But we often talk about reality as it's something outside of ourselves. But of course, this is just not how it is. You know, we are as much reality as anything else, aren't we? If it's a meaningful concept at all, of course it's not something we've got to gain. It's something that we participate in naturally, and so we can sort of understand what we're doing again. It's just a remembering or remembering ourselves as, in the sense of not as so much as memory, but as a remembering, a putting back together. So we're dismembered, and this is quite often how we experience life. We're born into this world, and most of us, to some extent, are dismembered by this world, by our experience of childhood, by our parents, by what happens to us. Bits of us kind of metaphorically get chopped off, get lost, get buried, because the situation we find ourselves in is just too painful, yeah? For one reason or the other. So we get dismembered, we get pulled apart, and then we're faced with this quest or this path of remembering, putting ourselves back together. Yeah? So when I say remembering, I'm also using it in this sort of way, to put back together. Yeah? We've lost parts of ourselves, they need to be recollected and put back together. And this, of course, brings us into the blue of Dionysus. This idea of dismembering and remembering. Funny enough, I was reminded of Dionysus last night when Mandava was talking about loosening, because one of the epithets for Dionysus is the loosener. He was known as the loosener. And funny enough, this remembering is also a loosening. This is how it is in this world of ours, this way of beginning to talk about things, is that everything seems to be, if not contradictory, double. There's always double vision. There's always more than one way. So remembering and a loosening actually go together. To remember ourselves, we've got to let go of something. And of course, this is the first stage of the alchemical process, this blackening, or this returning things back to something more elemental, something more primitive, something younger, in a sense, you could say, the original state of things, before they were organized, before they were channeled in certain directions. So this sort of, this is kind of a perhaps what we're doing. We're trying to remember, we're trying to put ourselves back together before we were broken, yeah? All of us, to some extent or other, and of course some people more than others, but all of us, to some extent or other, are kind of broken, a bit broken by life, yeah? I think it's more or less inevitable. And actually, oddly enough, of course, in the end, it's through the wound that we move on, yeah, that we actually become richer. But that's another story. We won't go there today. But this brokenness is also the opportunity to remember and put ourselves back together in a different way, in a new way. So that's one, all a bit kind of abstract, perhaps, I hope it's not too abstract, but one of the ways you can imagine, what we're doing. Of course, there's lots of ways we can, I think it's really important to realise there's lots of ways we can imagine what we're trying to do, and one isn't better than another. So very often we imagine the spiritual life as a kind of progressive purification. It's all quite difficult. What we're doing here is a bit more regressive. So it's sort of more based on this idea that what we need is already here, present. It needs to be remembered, so we need to sort of let ourselves fall apart back into something. So it's just another way of looking, or another way of imagining. And at different times in our life, we need different ways of imagining what we're doing. If we've only ever got one way of imagining what we're doing, it might serve us very well when we're young. So when we're young, this progressive mode, this heroic mode is natural to us. Yeah, and it's the right thing to be doing when we're young, I think. Though it still has its dangers. None of these things don't have their dangers. They all have their dangers. They all have their shadow side. Whether it's what I'm talking about, a kind of regressive remembering, of course they all have their risk. But when we're young, most of us are in some kind of heroic mode, or need to find some kind of heroic mode. We want to get out there and do things, make an impression, establish ourselves, blah, blah, blah. And this is completely legitimate. At some point, when we've done that, there has to be, you know, we've got a real problem if when the hero becomes the king, if they stay in that mode, they're a disaster for the kingdom. They're a disaster for the kingdom if they stay in that heroic mode. Something needs to shift, they need to shift. And this is the same with us as we move through life. We need different archetypal structures or archetypes to activate us in different ways. And we all find this, at any time in life, we get to a certain point in life and we think, actually, what's gone behind me, that was fine, it was fine. Or maybe it wasn't fine, either way. Maybe it was a disaster, who knows. But actually, that's not what I need anymore. Something needs. And I think one of the reasons we're here is trying to do this Buddhist lark is because we're trying to have that fluidity in our lives. We're trying to be able to say to ourselves, have that feeling, okay, now something else needs to come into my life. Now I need to be different in the world. My being needs to be expressed differently in the world, and this is right. And have the support and the courage to do this. And so many people, I think getting old is, or get up aging, is such an interesting process, because when you meet an old person that's kept their heart and mind open, there's nothing in more beautiful or inspiring than that. Nothing. But it's so easy for that not to happen, and for people just to get stuck in their whatever their track is, you know, whatever their track is. So again, I think the clue is, in a way, what these remarkable old people have is that they retain some essence from their youth, from their very, very early childhood, even from before they learned to talk. And this is right, that they retain some sense of what they came into the world with. Of course, this is a fanciful way of talking, yeah? It's a fanciful way of talking, but if you think you've come into the world with something very precious, and actually, whatever's happened to you in this life, it's not destroyed, yeah? It's not destroyed. And it can still be contacted somewhere. It might be buried under a lot of crap, but it can still be found. It's a jewel in the dung heap. You know? It's an image in Buddhism, isn't it? The jewel hidden in the lining of the coat. That we forget what's there. Anyway, you get the idea. But so, you know, Tom Waits has this thing, doesn't he? Always keep a diamond in your mind. Mm-hmm. Never let the weeds grow higher than the porch, and always keep a diamond in your mind. Always keep a sapphire in your mind. Mule variations, if you want to reference. Check it out, it's a great song. Always keep the diamond in your mind. So we're back with alchemical symbolism in a way, with the minerals, yeah. And this case the diamond. Okay, that's enough for this morning, isn't it? So we'll just continue on our merry way, as it were, whatever it is we're trying to do. Maybe we'll figure it out. Maybe not.